why don't you give me a little intro,
and we're just gonna roll from there.
All right. For intro, what do you want? What are you looking for?
Name. Where you from? A little bit of history. Where you grew up? How you grew up?
All right. So name's Jacob Maxwell. Grew up Colorado.
What part?
Durango.
Okay.
So the lower southwest part. I grew up, you know, hunting, fishing, spending all my time outdoors, doing that, just kind of messing around. Ever since, you know, like I was about 14, I started going and visiting the recruiter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he told me, you know, get the fuck out of here. You're too young. So I, ever since I was really young, that's what I wanted to
you
do,
knew.
Be a Marine. Yeah.
So what was the, what led you to that?
I don't know. My grandfather was a Green Beret, and he did that, and he really wanted me to go that route.
Yeah.
But you know, going and visiting the recruiters and things like that, the way the Marine recruiter was like, hey, you know, you're too fucking young, get the fuck out of here. And he's like, and then talking to him and different things, it was like, okay, that's where I want to go. I don't want to, you know, these other guys are soft. I don't want to go do that stuff. So, yeah. So ever since then, I was like, would go do like pool functions with them, even though I was, you know, too young to even be close to joining.
So they let you tag along for certain
things?
Yeah,
every once in a while.
Okay.
Do things like that. Yeah, so, and then it came time, I think, I was in MEPS September 10th, 2001. So then
really?
I finished MEPS and then went, and I was sitting in high school class September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was speech class or something like that. And I was like, they stopped everything. You know, the news came up and I was like, oh, I guess it's on. Mm-hmm. So.
And you were, what grade were you in when?
I was a senior then.
So, okay, so I was a junior. I'm a year behind you then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So, well, I finished school and then July of 2002, I went in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
Yep.
How was that? And you, so you're out of Colorado and you're a West Coast Marine?
West Coast Marine, yep. So okay. Pendleton, that was good. Boot camp, you know, it was boot camp.
Yeah.
I think it was, I was right at that phase where they were transitioning out of tricolors and
yep.
into digi.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was one of the first digi platoons.
Yep.
So that was interesting, especially, you know, finishing SOI and getting to the fleet and you're one
Everyone's
of the first.
Looking at you.
Yeah, they're like, who the hell are these weirdos?
Right.
I
bet you that was a weird period because I remember when the Navy switched over to their blue digi. It was like the most, and I remember why, I was like, what is that? Like the first time we saw it, you know, because we were right there in Del Mar with the Corman School.
Right.
So I remember seeing those guys for the first time. So you were wearing it. I mean, I'm sure you got some looks.
Oh, yeah, I did. And it was like, it was a weird time. So you're trying to like fit in. So we're like wearing the, you know, polishing our boots. So we're like, we're not shit bags. We can polish boots too. And, you know, wearing the digis and trying to match it all up. So it was an interesting time. It was fun though.
What was boot camp like for you? You seem like a quiet guy, kind of laid back. Were you kind of a...
I'm a quiet guy, pretty laid back. I'm good at PT, stuff like that. So I did all right. I just kind of... It was quiet. There was a few times... I remember the funniest time in boot camp is when we went up north to Edson Range.
Yep.
It was like teams week, so you do like your little chores or whatever you have to do. I ended up working in the chow hall for that week. But I was like cutting my fingernails one day over the trash can, and one of the chefs was like, hey, what are you doing? Goes back and see your drill instructor. You're not supposed to be cutting your fingernails in here. And he was yelling at me. And so I go back, and the drill instructor, I think it was the J hat, was in there by himself. And he's like, what the fuck are you doing back here?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I was cutting my fingernails. And he's like, good, go get changed. And he didn't even give me time to change. So I was out in the pit like doing jumping jacks with my pants down around my ankles, and it was a fucking
typical
mess.
Typical boot camp stuff.
Yeah, but that was about the most exciting experience I think I had in all of boot camp. I was pretty quiet guy.
Okay. Yeah, I always like to ask because I was not. I was public enemy number one to every drill instructor. I just had that face. But so you did you join as an 03 or what was your contract?
Yeah, I joined as an 03.
I guess I shouldn't even have to have asked that since you were so moto at that age. I mean, you're not going to go in and be some intel or, you know.
Yeah. No,
different.
Straight up 03. Well, I wanted to do, you know, like either go sniper growing up the way I did. I grew up out in the woods,
for
outfitting
sure.
and guiding, hunting stuff. So
yep.
That was big. So I was always I want to either go sniper or recon route.
Yeah.
It didn't really work out that way. I was like sniper, platoon sergeant, things like that, but I just didn't get to do the schools, everything just worked differently for me. So,
so you get through boot camp, go to SOI, and you get attached to what unit first?
So my first unit was 1-1.
How was that?
It was good. I don't know if you remember back in the time, those early 2000s was all fun. 1-1 is what they call it. Okay. So, I did 3 deployments with them. So I was with 1-1 for 4 years.
Really?
Our first, we did 2 MUs. Both times we ended up in Iraq. So, Baghdad, and then we did some stuff over by the Tigris and, a few little things over there.
What years were those?
2003 was my first deployment with them. And then I think 2004, 2005, and then I did another one, 2005, 6-ish.
Okay. How were those? How was the first one? I mean, 2003, things were, I mean, they'd popped off, but how?
It was funny listening to Franklin, like some of the Humvees, and I was in a track company as well.
Okay.
So riding around in the softbacks and the highbacks and having the no doors, and I remember, like, IEDs were just kind of starting to be a thing. So they're like, oh, just pack sandbags on the floors.
Blast mats.
I remember, like, sitting in a track just full of sandbags where you're, like, you know, you got the middle bench down the center of it, and your, like, knees are way up to your chin because you got sandbags all over.
Yes, that's hilarious that you've experienced. Not a lot of guys get to experience the back of an Amtrak, which is – it's a fascinating place. But, I mean, dude, it blows my mind to have you guys just – I mean, every time I hear it, that you guys were just rolling around softbacks.
Yeah.
No doors, like no turrets, no up-armored anything.
Nothing. I remember, like, over by the Tigris, sitting there, and we're, like, in an old steel factory. It's kind of where we set up our little platoon patrol base out of. And there would be, like, pop shots coming across from the Tigris, and we're just, like, chilling out there in our beanies and our boonies and soft covers and, like, hanging out, and it was like
rounds would just come zip
by. it was a weird time.
It's weird how you very quickly adapt to that type of stress, which went from, like, at first, like, oh my god, we're gonna die, and then it's just like, oh, not even close, but it's like 50 feet out, like, oh, that's not bad, like, oh, we're good. Like,
it was a and it was summertime too. It was so hot, and I remember the tracks kept catching on fire, the engines, and, like, just being in the back of those sometimes was miserable, but when we were out on foot and doing patrols, it was like, can we just, you know, rock our boonies and, like, our whatever, not our flax, but just our chest rigs.
Yeah.
And dude, it was like pure chaos back then.
That's, dude, that, I mean, bro, I love listening and talking to you guys that were, like, the initial OG vets, you know, during our time, because how much had changed in just couple of years versus, like, you, I mean, they're, like, you're just saying, like, rocking just, you know, boonie covers and chest care, you know, plate carriers or whatever, like, little chest rigs, to, like, when we're coming in, like, dude, you had to have throat protectors, your glasses on, goggles, I mean, PPE, gloves. I mean, it was just, like, such a nightmare. Crazy. I couldn't even.
Just even from that first deployment we did to, you know, move into the next one, was like already, like, a huge difference. Like, you're not going anywhere without your flak, or
you couldn't even get out of your vehicle when we were there. Like, it was then again, on the deployment I'm referring to, our platoon sergeant was the absolute just biggest, and I don't even care how I look in the cameras, when that guy was the most worthless piece of shit I've ever met in my life. Like, if you ask my wife, there's one person on this planet that you just get it. It's him. He's just a coward. But so yeah, he made our lives absolute living hell, because he was scared. And so he made it trickle downhill. You know, obviously shit rolls downhill in the Marine Corps very fast. But so your first deployment, you get there, and where were you, where'd you guys head to? So you did a MU. So you took a Navy ships from San Diego, or did you come right off? Were you on the back of tracks? Did you push?
Well, yeah, we came out of the ship.
On tracks into tracks, Kuwait.
Into Kuwait.
Okay, so then in Kuwait, you guys were probably at Kuwaiti Naval Base for a few days, and then you guys flew up, or did you lowboy up in vehicles?
We flew up in helos, and then they lowboyed some of the other stuff up, like the tracks and things like that.
Yeah, how was that?
It was interesting. We spent, like, probably a week or so in Kuwait.
Okay.
We did some training, some of their ranges and different things like that. And then flew in, I mean, the first time kind of going in there and going to your first big real FOB was it was the worst because it was pouring rain when we got to our first like FOB. It was an Army, I think. I can't remember the name of it. It was an Army one, and it was like, they're like, all right, here, your tents are over here. And we go in there, and there was like literally 3 feet of standing water in these tents and like boards. It was
pallets.
Horrible. Yeah, it was like pallets, but like kind of floating on water. It was a mess. So we get in there and kind of like get situated, and they're trying to pump water out and like get it somewhat dry for us. But that being their first time, and they're like, we were having like mortar attacks and different things going on. And it was like, oh my God, like we're in it now. Like this is, this is what everybody's been talking about. So, from there we'd kind of like punch out and do little, patrols and different things. It was interesting. It was kind of quiet. I was still like, new to everything. So, you know, trying to figure everything out and, and go from there. But,
and then, so that was pretty, not a super eventful, you know, because some deployments are like that and some aren't. Then you ended up doing how many more deployments?
I did two more deployments with 1-1.
With 1-1?
Yep.
And then how were those? Anything crazy on those?
The second one, it was another MU that we inserted into Iraq. We did some stuff. I'm trying to think of the operation. I can't think of it off the top of my head. But that was some of the stuff along the Tigris and different things like that.
How was that? I mean, isn't that like a pretty beautiful area?
It was really cool over there.
A lot of history in that area.
We did a lot of fighting holes in the orchards and stuff. Really? So that was really interesting.
Like the guys were in fighting holes?
Yeah, like we had our patrol bases. We were all on foot for like, I think we were off the ship for like 2 or 3 months there.
Uh-huh.
And we were all on foot setting up fighting holes.
Really?
Through different orchards and moving around. And then we did that last little push on the Tigris, and then that was kind of it. We went back on ship. I think that was the time that... we did that, Indonesia had that big, tsunami. So we did some relief stuff for them as well.
One of my best friends, he helped do that. I wonder if you guys were, McConnell.
Might have been on the same
McConnell
ships.
Was on, it was a Mew, and they ended up going like, over there, and they were digging bodies out of mud. And how was that? Okay. Were you doing that?
I did some of the, stuff to deliver food onto the beaches and things like that, but we didn't get to go like much further than that.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. He said that they were like, they would dig up a car and there'd be like a whole family just inside the car, just trapped in the mud that was been there for weeks or whatever. Obviously all of them had passed, but like he said that was horrible.
Yeah, we were out on ships. I remember like, because we were docked there and they were like running helos back and forth and food and different things, and you just see bodies in like people's house stuff floating all over in the water around the ship. It was
really
crazy, like everywhere in the ocean, just bodies and tons of stuff. It was wild.
I heard the smell there was absolutely horrendous. Yeah. Like it was just rot.
Yeah, it was horrible.
I couldn't even imagine. So you weren't in Iraq very long, your second deployment then?
Not very long.
That's nice then.
Then the third deployment was a flyover, so we flew right in, and we were... in Al Karma, Iraq. Okay. So I think that's just northeast of Fallujah.
Yeah.
So we spent pretty much the whole 7 months right around there, that Ramadi and Fallujah area. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty wild. During that deployment, I got hit by 3 IEDs.
Let's talk about this.
So
first one, first day.
The first day. It was in a high back Humvee, actually. So I was a squad leader at the time. Oh, my!
So explain what a high back is real quick.
So a high back Humvee, just a Humvee, but the back of it is...
like a pickup truck with tall walls on it.
With tall walls.
So if you're standing in the back, it's probably just below chest height.
Right.
So people can picture this.
Yep. And these weren't up-armored either. I mean, I think the doors were up-armored at this point, and they had, like, some plates on the bottom of the vehicles, but that was it.
And you're in the back.
I was in the front. I was a squad leader at the time. My squad leader going over there actually got shot like 2 weeks into that deployment, so I had to take over the squad.
Really?
Yeah, it was crazy.
Did he make it?
Yeah, he made it. They medevaced him out, and he was fine.
Yeah.
So we were doing patrols, things like that, and we just found a huge weapons cache, and we were coming back in, and it was funny, every single time I got in the vehicles, I wore my earplugs. every single time I got hit by an IED, I had my earplugs out.
Oh.
It was the weirdest thing. So I was like, I just need to put them in just to not
leave
get
them
hit.
In. Yeah.
But we were cruising down this road, and all of a sudden, just the front of the vehicle just disappeared on my side. And I had guys in the back of the high back. There was like four or five of my guys in the back of the high back. And I just remember like everything going dark and the front of the vehicle just disappearing. And I was like, look over at my driver and I was like, just keep going. And it was like, he was trying to go, but it was just the whole front.
Nothing was gone.
Side was gone. So he couldn't go anywhere. And I was like, fuck. So I was like, couldn't get out. I was trying to open the door to get out and check on guys and see. And I couldn't get out, so they had to pry the door open for me. And then I'd get out, and there's like this giant hole where the IED was buried.
Really? So is that big? Do you think they buried it too deep?
It was definitely way too deep on that one.
Something like a hole that big, I mean, should have obliterated
a
Humvee.
We got really – everyone I get hit by, I've been super lucky. I've been hit five times.
Holy shit, dude. Okay.
So,
all right. Where do we even start? So you got hit by the first one. So everybody was good?
Everybody's good. I had some like bleeding in my ears and some fluid and stuff. And they're like,
damn, you got lucky.
They're like, this was a time when like IEDs were just really like, okay, you know, if you get hit a certain amount of times, you got to go back. They hadn't started any of that shit yet. So it was like, go to medical. They sent me to Fallujah to get checked out. And then later that night, I was back out. And they're like, oh, you're good. It's just a little bit of fluid on the ears. You'll be fine. And so carry on. And then a couple more times during that deployment, I got hit two more times.
We're not blowing through those. I want to hear about these. I want to hear about them.
So
number two.
Number two, we were... Oh, gosh, we were kind of running our own little base. There's a spot they call the Lollipop in El Carma. It was like where the police station was, the big police station in this roundabout. Have you ever seen the guy on the microphone on the YouTube videos where he's like, come out and fight, you pussies?
Oh, yeah.
That was one of my really good friends.
Really?
Yeah, and he's right there in the Lollipop.
Okay.
But it was a different company. He was in a different company, but so... Right there, we were doing patrols and stuff and getting ready to roll out and just going down right back. We'd use this road all the time, and it was just going back to base, to the patrol base, and another one, almost same type scenario as the first one.
Really?
Hit on my side, like, I think we were at an up armor with a turret on it this time. And same thing, just killed the front of the vehicle, got super lucky, and got towed out again on that one. But
are you just at this point like, fuck, like, I'm ready to go home?
Yeah, kind of.
So everybody in the vehicle is good then?
Everybody in the vehicle is fine.
Dang, dude, you got lucky.
This is like, everybody's starting to give me shit. I actually got a tattoo on my arm. It says lucky in Arabic.
Yeah.
Because all the Iraqis that were with us are like, what the hell, dude? This guy's like
two times now. Like, you're becoming a legend.
Yeah, and then the third time happened. It's almost same type thing. And my CEO's like, all right, nobody is riding with Maxwell again. Like, even my squad was like
no,
I don't want to ride. You can drive yourself around from now on.
So are you the only one that's been hit three times, or are these guys with you every single time?
I think it's been a different person every single time with me.
Okay.
But it is always my vehicle in every convoy.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Were there any other vehicles hit in between these times, or are you just like three times it happened to be you and all every time?
Within the platoon, I think we had a couple other ones, but nothing.
You're collecting the majority of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that was really it. Within the company, we had quite a few.
Yeah.
But... yeah, within my platoon, I was the one that seemed to be
the
lucky.
Magnet.
Yeah,
that's wild.
Yeah. So that karma was kind of crazy because we had some suicide bombers and different things roll into our PBs.
What was that like? That's pretty scary. That's a pretty scary thing dealing with somebody
that
you know
was
that.
Really scary. We had a bongo truck pull in to one of ours, packed full of explosives, and it blew up. And I always remember this one because this dude's face, like, it peeled his face off, and it landed on the Humvee.
Really?
That we were standing next to, and his, like, you could see his face just peeled off of his body on the Humvee, like, flat. It was like something you would see in a movie almost.
And this was the suicide bomber?
Yeah.
And his...
He drove the bongo truck, and it blew, right? But his face came off, and it was, like, laying on... It was the wildest thing I ever seen.
Like, just a straight-up mask.
Just, like, a mask laying on the Humvee hood.
Of this guy's face.
Yeah. It was wild.
How far did this face fly to land on the
Probably
Humvee?
Only like 20 yards or so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we had quite a few guys hurt on that because it was just like a temporary patrol base.
Yeah.
We just set up in like this little
just a little fob.
Compound. Yeah. And had a couple like security vehicles and things set up. So we had quite a few guys.
This dude comes just rolling in, huh?
Yep. Just hauled ass right in, right at the entrance of, did you know how the compounds in Iraq, they have like those big mud brick walls.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he just blew right in through that and then just detonated.
Anybody killed?
Nobody killed.
Yeah, maybe you are good luck instead of bad luck.
Some people say that. So
I mean, that's.
But yeah. So that was a karma. So that was fun. I mean, we did a lot of crazy stuff on that deployment.
Like what?
You know,
what's crazy for you? Because everybody's got different levels of crazy.
Lots of like roadblocks and different ambush things.
Did you run any ambushes like in palm groves or anything like that?
We did a few small ones. None real like that really kicked off anything crazy. Okay. We did a lot of patrols. We ended up towards the end of the deployment going over by Ramadi.
Yeah.
And doing what was that route over there?
Bronze, Mobile.
Nah, we were on Bronze and Mobile, but the route...
Uranium or whatever is one of them?
Oh, I can't remember, but we set up a patrol base on that for about a week, and that was... I just remember standing out on the roads for hours and hours in the heat and just dying. And there was that dam over there just south of Fallujah that we spent a lot of time at, too.
Not Haditha. Haditha was north,
north. So we spent a lot of time at that dam, and I remember just seeing like fishing bloated bodies out of that thing.
Really?
Yeah, of Iraqis and different things. So that was
because they were kind of just murdering people and tossing them in the rivers there. I mean, I remember that we would get briefed on it that don't touch anything because they're just. I mean, it was a lot of the guys that were getting caught that were there. There were. It was the family of like interpreters and things like that.
Just seemed like a couple bodies a day we'd pull out of that dam. Just like sit there and just sit right just on
pile
the
up.
Yeah, it was crazy.
You know, wild the things that we've
seen. And, yeah, and then I don't know. At the time, you're like
desensitized to it.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
I think back on it now, and I was like, man, I didn't even really think of it as anything besides a job, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely weird.
It's weird to process now. Especially like, you know, I was put in a situation once where this woman like handed me her dead child, right? Like rolled up in her and like,
yeah.
And I go, like, what am I supposed to do? Like, no, take your kid. Like, I don't want it, you know, but now it's like being a father, different mindset, different stage in my life. Like I would be like, I wouldn't even know how to process it now, but like as a kid, like, you know, you think you would handle it worse then, but you know, like, look, I mean, you're just, oh, there's another floater. Like, you don't get the cookout and reel them in, you know, but it's like now if I saw somebody, I'd be like, what the, like, you know, it's different. Like, I mean, if somebody handed me their dead child now, how do I help? You know, then it was like, I don't want to deal with this. Like,
it's like, oh, it's out of my,
sorry, lady. Like, I don't know what you want me to do. You know, and plus we were worried about it being packed full of explosives and everything else. Cause they were doing that. We'd found a bunch of suicide vests and all that stuff during that whole time. And like little kid ones. So everybody was on high alert with kids, but it's wild. The fact that like, we just looked at it like a job. And I'm sure it's the same for law enforcement and firefighters and, you know, paramedics have to deal with the same crap every day, but it's like, it's just like, that's just, all right, what are we going to discover today?
Yeah.
You know,
I've had many, many conversations with, you know, like a therapist about it too. Is like, is that weird? You know, I just thought of it as a job or is it think of these things as a job. And I don't know. It's crazy.
It's interesting.
Back on.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thought, you know, to be able to sit and go back and you tell the stories and like we laugh about them and things, but at the, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, dude, that was somebody's dad, somebody's mom. I mean, it's someone's loved one, right. That someone's child at some point. And it's like, but you know, we were there for a reason, thought we were doing a mission, and you know, it was definitely different times. That's for sure. So you do, you get hit three times on that deployment.
Three times on that one deployment.
Fuck, man. And you, they didn't like try to pull you, evaluate, nothing. They're just like, all right, you're good. Like patted you on the back. Like
nothing. Nothing ever came of it. That was it.
That is insane. So you come back from that deployment.
Came back from that deployment. And then I went to SOI. Was an SOI instructor.
How was that?
It was awesome.
What year was that?
2007 to 2010.
Okay.
So I did that. I helped start up Combat Hunter program.
No kidding. Yeah. I went through the I went through the Combat Tracker one, which I thought was the same thing for a little bit, but maybe it wasn't.
Yeah. It all kind of combined. So okay. David Donlin.
Because I remember they used to call it that. Then it was Combat. I don't know why. I got a certificate that said Combat Tracker on it, but it was, that's how they started it. Yep. I thought it was Combat Hunter at first.
It started kind of like a bunch of different things. Yeah, it started out as like tracking and then, you know, doing the observation and different things. So yeah, I got to help start that up.
So you were at SOI the same, what year?
2007 to 10.
Yeah. So I was at the White House. I was the first MARDIV color sergeant during, while you were up there. So we would have to go get SOI instructors and and students to come help do the garrison flag. And it was a nightmare. Yeah. So I was the first MARDIV color sergeant during while you were up at SOI. So I was over there often. We worked with a lot of guys that were doing that whole thing. So that's funny. I'm sure we've crossed paths at some point.
Guaranteed.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
Yeah. Hilarious. So SOI instructor, I haven't talked to an instructor in a while.
Okay.
What's it like? So SOI is a school of infantry.
Right.
So after, you know, the guys we've talked about on the podcast, for everybody listening, go through boot camp. Everybody else in the Marine Corps goes to their job MOSs, every grunt goes to the School of Infantry. What's it like? Because I was an instructor. I was a tracker though. But I was an instructor. So I love hearing other instructor stories. What's it like picking up a platoon full of brand new teenagers that want to be grunts? Like, how is that? Especially during that time, because things have started to. I feel that 2000. So I was an instructor 9, 10, so 11 and 12, I was an instructor, and it was a huge shift during that time as far as the quality and the mindset of kids coming into the Marine Corps. Cause then they like knew their rights. They'd request to talk to the chaplain. I want to talk, you know, so I was a staff sergeant when I had my platoon, and it was they weren't the same kids when we came into the Corps.
Right.
So how was it for you? What's it like picking up a bunch of young kids that want to be grunts and full of piss and vinegar?
It's like your worst nightmare.
Yeah, how so?
No, it was all right. It's fun. Like, it was interesting getting to, like, get new minds and teach them new things. And, you know, especially the ones that were really into it and the ones that you could tell really wanted to be there.
Yeah.
And, you know, learn the stuff. That was awesome. But there's some that were just, like, from day one, you got those pain in the ass kids that are just hard to deal with. And, you know, trying to make them make a turnaround and like, you know, you wanted this because you signed the paper. So now here you are, you might as well, you know, take advantage of it, learn, because someday your life is going to, you know, depend on knowing this stuff or not knowing it. And I had a lot of fun with it. Yeah. It was a lot of hours. I think a lot of people think drill instructors work a lot of long hours, but at SOI I remember I lived in Stuart Mesa at the time on the, you know, the south side of Pendleton. And I would wake up at 2 in the morning to get there by 3 to wake the students up to get them ready for whatever ranges and stuff. And then sometimes I wouldn't get home till like 11 or midnight.
Turn around and do it again.
Yep. And it was rough. A lot of times I just slept in the office.
And how many years did you do that for?
I did that for 3 years.
Damn. Were you married at this time? Or?
I got married. Well, this year is my wife's 20-year anniversary.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah. So I got, I think right after I got into 1-1, like a year or two later, okay, we got married.
So she's hanging on. I mean, that's got to
be
rough.
Yeah, she's been in it for the long haul.
Good for her. So she is an OG wife.
She is. Yeah. She is. Okay. She's put up with a lot of shit, especially with me.
Only
I'm
imagine.
Yeah, so.
Aren't we all, right? So you do the SOI thing. I mean, I'm sure you got some, dude, you have to have some crazy stories of SOI because we were always going over there for something. There was kids always getting in trouble. Like
always. I've had to. There was a few nights I had to drive down like Tijuana and pick kids up at the border.
Yeah.
And just.
I was one of those kids. 100%. 100%.
I was like such a good kid most of my Marine Corps career.
Oh, I took the opposite path of everything.
I was like, nope, I'm not getting
busted. I swam upstream against everything. Everything.
Oh, yeah.
No, we used to get some crazy kids that would over at SOI. I mean, the stories we'd hear that come out of there, because, you know, with being the first MARDIV side of things, we'd always see all the incident reports and all that stuff, and there was always crazy. I mean, those guys, it seemed like it was just nonstop over there.
It was always – the weekends were always interesting for sure, especially if you
Monday
were on
mornings.
Duty. Yeah. You
dreaded
never
Mondays.
Got a weekend that was just like, oh, we made it through clean. There was never a weekend like that.
No.
When I was there too, I don't know. The Sergeant Major Vines was the sergeant major there as well. So
yes, I remember him. He was a horrible person.
Being a
wasn't
staff
he?
NCO checking in for duty with him was always interesting because you knew it was going to be an adventure.
Right. So. Okay, I do remember him.
Yeah, he was.
Didn't make life easy, right?
No, never.
I didn't have to deal with him most of the time directly, but I remember him specifically. Like, he was not a pleasant person.
No. I mean, he meant well, but he was just, oh, my gosh, he was always on you. You could never, like marching platoons to chow in the morning. If you weren't doing it right, he was over there. He'd take over your platoon and be like, this is how you march him. And it was crazy. I'm like,
it's crazy. I wish we could go and find guys that were like that, that just, because there's different types of Marines, or I guess veterans, but I'm going to speak on behalf of Marines. Like, when I was in the Marine Corps, it was a job to me. Like, it was a 9-to-5. I left my uniform at work. Like, when I got to that point, obviously not in some boot, but
I did the same.
Everything stayed at work. I came home in my civvies. I turned it off. So you have that style of Marine.
Right.
And then you have guys that are just, it's becomes their identity. It's who they are. It's all they ever know, and it's all that he'll ever be. And then it's like, I wish I can find, he's a perfect example, like, what's his life now on the outside?
I was just thinking of this the other day. Because I have a lot of friends that retired with me that was their whole life. Uh-huh. Like, that's all they did and knew and cared about was Marine Corps. And I'm like, man, I wonder, like, how they're doing now that they're retired. And a lot of them end up, you know, getting that fixed by going and working for base and stuff. I told my wife when I retired, I was like, I'm done.
Out.
Like, that... I'm good.
I have a bunch of buddies right now that are all GS whatever on Pendleton because it's like they enjoy it, but God, when I got out, man, I could not run fast enough. Like, I was that dude that did a wheelie through the front gate, like middle finger, like, come
later,
and catch
assholes.
Me. I'm never coming back. Like, and I haven't. I've gone back for a couple of retirements, but you know, other than that, it was one of those. So back on track with you, you're up at SOI dealing with all that wildness. So you were grunt. Do you remember Master Gunny French by any chance? So he was the O3 monitor. I worked directly for him.
Really?
And then Sergeant Major, Master Gunny LeHue. That was Trax. Damn, what was his name? But Master Gunny French, I worked directly for him. He was the O3 monitor.
Yeah.
Man, he was like, I used to get in so much trouble up there at division, like, wouldn't salute some, like, butter bar female lieutenant.
Oh,
like,
God.
You know, and go, there was this one female Marine. This woman was the devil. Her name was Staff Sergeant Smith Livy.
Hmm.
She had her name, and she refused to take her husband's name, so they, like, split it on her name tag,
I've
right?
I've heard of her before.
She was this black staff sergeant, and she was the first female, like, on a poster for the McMap.
Yeah.
She was the first black.
Okay.
It was her. She was the devil. Absolute devil. So I worked for Master Gunny French, which was this old, good old boy from
Kentucky,
old school, as long as you did your job, and if you were just a squared away, you can get away with murder. Right. Like, I could have murdered somebody running his office and be like, okay, this will happen. It was, and he'd be like, I got you. Sorry. Like, you know, he loved me. That guy, I was like a made man. I was protected under Master awesome. Gunny. And, man, one day because I was the color sergeant. So no matter what, if you were on the color sergeant or the color guard, that outweighed any position that you had.
Right.
So my riflemen, they worked upstairs in S3, whatever it was. But, you know, they're all paper guys. And I worked in the G3 in the division in the secured vault. And so my daily job would be, I'd have to brief General Waldhauser, Sergeant Major Carter on incidences that were going on in Afghan, Iraq, all that stuff. But like my main job, that I was up there, got selected and made it to be the first Marine Division color sergeant. So that trumped anything. So I go up one day and she's brand new upstairs and I walk and I'm like, hey, let's go. We got to go practice. And she's like, who the fuck you think you are taking my guys? I was like, who do you think you are? And I didn't know who she was. Like, and who out? She was just locked and loaded, man. Yeah. Like just wound up. Bro, I've had my ash chewed a lot. Like a day without an ash chewing is like a day without sunshine, you know, like that old phrase. This woman just goes straight ballistic, like knife handing, screaming. Keep in mind, I'd already done my deployments. I've already done my time.
Yeah.
I got hand selected to go and represent the most decorated division in the Marine Corps. Like, dude, I'm walking around like a chip of mine. I'm untouchable. And this staff sergeant's chewing my ass. And I stop her right in the middle of chewing my ass. I was like, hey, Gunny. Oh, she was a Gunny. Gunny Smith, Olivia. Staff sergeant Gunny either. Well, it doesn't matter. And I was like, hey, you can save your breath. I don't need to hear it. I just need these two guys. We got to go practice. Dude, this woman goes ballistic. I was like, who the fuck you think you are? No. You some goddamn war hero or something. And I was like, yeah, I am. Like, wasn't, but I'm like, I am. Why do you think I'm up here doing this? I was like, you can't tell me what to do. Bro, she grabs me, like walks me down to Master Gunny French. And she like kicks his door. And I was like, I'm like looking at her like, ooh, you messed up. Like, you don't know who you're messing
with. Can't wait to see how this goes.
And she's like, we need to talk. And he stands up. You know, he was a short little stocky dude. And he goes, I don't know who the fuck you think you're talking to. He goes, you don't ever talk to my sergeant. It just rips her a new one. And dude, after that, I was public enemy number. She would look around for him.
Dude, that's awesome.
I would have to like look for her because if I couldn't get to him fast enough, dude, she had me. But man, the division was insane. Sorry, I'll get back on track to that.
Awesome.
But yeah, so I'm sure we've crossed paths with a lot of people
guaranteed.
Up there. That was an interesting time because coming from like a combat unit up to division and dealing with females and women like that. You know how it is. Like, we never cross paths ever, especially being in Del Mar where we were, you'd have the Corman school and that stuff. But like, as far as tracks didn't exist, and I'd spent my whole first enlistment pretty much in workups or deployed. And so when I went up to division, learning how to work with female Marines,
it's a whole new ball game.
I wasn't ready for it. They'd come in and be like, And like the way that they would address me as a sergeant, and they were like a lance corporal, because in the different MOSs, they let them talk to them differently. And like if that was some boot ass lance corporal come walking in talking to me, we'd haze the shit out of some kid that. And so these women would walk in, these female Marines would walk in, and I was there with one of my buddies at the time, and this dude had like two Purple Hearts. He had like three NAMs with V's on them. I mean, dude, just like this dude was a freaking war hero, like legit squared away dude. And man, he grabbed this chick one time because she yad him, and he grabbed her by her collar and like threw her through the door out of our office. Bro, it was like a hornet nest. Like, running down the street. She's crying, like, pointing. And we had Master Gunny French, you know, because we were allowed to get away with anything. But, dude, we were just like he's like, hey, after he had our back, he's like, y'all ain't in your units anymore. You got to learn to work with these female Marines. And we were just like, what the hell? And it's a different world. Yeah. Different world. And that's where, like, you have the whole pogue mentality. And even though, like, me being a tracker, we're technically pogues, but, like, we're always attached to grunts. We just deployed it as grunts ourselves. But it's like, we didn't associate with like anybody like that because we're like, God, because you would see there's a different mindset between, you know, combat units versus like some admin unit and how they talk to each other, how they mm-hmm. fraternize. They're like corporals hanging out with sergeants and staff sergeants. Like that shit never happened in our units.
Yeah.
Ever.
It's a different world for sure.
It really is. So after SOI, where did you head after that?
So after SOI, I went to 2-4.
Okay.
So right when I got there, they were on a MEW. So I kind of.
What year?
This was 2010.
Okay. So yeah, I was with 2-4 in 2007.
Ramadi time frame.
Yep.
So they were just coming off of MEW, and I was just checking in. So I did like all the, get them ready to get back and get their barracks and stuff set up. And then like 2 months after they got back, the company I checked into was like, hey, we're taking 90 guys for combat replacement, volunteers only, to go to Afghanistan.
To replace who?
It was a couple different units, but it was an East Coast unit. I want to say like 3-7 or something like that at the time. It was in Marja.
Okay.
So it was when they were doing the push through Marja. So we went up there. It was only supposed to be like 3 months long. We ended up being there almost 6 months.
Damn.
Like we had a sniper platoon and a couple other guys. We actually, the 90 guys that we had ended up getting split and going two different AOs.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and that was a wild.
This is
2010. Yeah, 2010, 2011.
This wasn't with Dark Horse with. Who's the Dark Horse? I just had Ryan on the show, Magania. I was when I was at Division, we went to be combat replacements for him.
It might have been.
Okay. We might have almost been on the same appointment. I told the story how we got in line. You should listen to it on the way up, but like they were taking combat replacements and we got in line and we ended up getting breakfast burritos, but they stopped the guy in front of, literally the guy in front of us was the last one they closed the book. But
really?
That was the go place, replace the Dark Horse guys. They were combat ineffective. They got their asses handed to them.
We did some stuff with Dark Horse, I know for sure. But the majority of the time we ended up spending near Marja on Sailor Laura and Apes. I don't know if heard of any of those places, but those places were like the Wild West of Afghanistan.
Really?
So,
why is that?
There was this route, Apes.
Okay.
That we had a little platoon size PB on, and that every time we went on that route, it was either an ambush or IEDs, like nonstop. And we were so undermanned that most of the time it was like resupplies. We'd go, me, the company gunny would take like whatever we had.
Yeah.
And we would be like, me and the company gunny were multiple times like out sweeping the roads ourselves for the vehicles. Because we couldn't take guys out of the turrets. All we had is guys for drivers, turrets, and then a couple guys.
So you didn't have any crew in the back?
No. So
you're running skeleton crews then?
Basically.
Damn, in Afghan.
In Afghanistan. And, dude, there was like so many times we got ambushed on that route. It was just me and the company gunny outside of the vehicle, like running and gunning through these wadis and different things and trying to figure out like what we're going to do and move the vehicles. But there's so many IEDs, you couldn't just like push vehicles up. So trying to sweep these roads to make sure they're clear.
Did you not step on any?
One of the times I was like, me and the company gunny were out there and it was just after a firefight and we were sitting there like we were having a smoke and talking to each other. And I looked down and I'm like, oh, fuck. And I'm standing right on a lamp cord. And I was like...
What's a lamp cord?
Like an actual lamp? Like a white lamp cord. And I was like, fuck, man, we're standing on an IED right now. And the company gunny looks down. He's like, oh, motherfucker. And so we call EOD out because they went everywhere with us there because we had so many things. They come up, and it was a pressure release we were standing on. We just got lucky that nothing triggered on us.
What?
Yeah.
How were you finding these? Were they just laying there? Were they not digging them? Or were you just looking for...
That was dug in. It was just, I barely saw the lamp cord just like sticking out to wherever power supply was run to.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and the EOD guys are out there like, fuck, man, you guys are on a pressure release right here. Like, so it took them a while to get it out. And
you standing there the whole time, or did you back off?
Well, I backed off I was like, this is not a good spot.
So when you guys are running and gunning down these roads, just you and your guns, are you fine? I mean, are some of them, are you looking for, like, fresh dug-up dirt? I mean,
you're trying to as much as possible.
So you're doing the old fives and 25s while you're in the middle of a firefight or what?
Yeah, you're trying to, yeah.
Damn, dude.
And just, yeah, it was, that was like crazy.
How often are you doing this?
Once a week at least. And then I ended up taking, my platoon sergeant ended up, that had the platoon that I took over, ended up leaving partway through because he ended up getting out of the Marine Corps.
Uh-huh.
So I took over that platoon that was on that patrol base, and that was crazy. We ended up shutting it down, but
why is that?
Just because there was no need to have it there anymore, and it was so dangerous. Just getting in and out was just a pain in the ass.
Really?
Yeah.
That bad, huh?
It was bad. So that was one of the other. My fourth ID was actually on that road that
Let's
I got
hear
hit
this
by.
One.
So it was in an MRAP.
Okay.
It wasn't a big one. It was.
I mean, I'm going to stop you. Do any of these guys on this deployment know many times you've been blown up before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the company commander's like.
Okay.
they always give me shit about
it. Did you get
it.
Any Purple Hearts or anything from
I have a Purple Heart.
None
the last
from the three before?
None from the three before. None for. I didn't get one for this.
Okay, let's hear this.
One.
Let's hear number four.
So it was on that road, Apes. Just cruising down. I think we were like. The second vehicle, and it just so happened to hit the pressure plate right, and it just blew up. Being in an MRAP, it didn't do anything. It just, like, slowed us down a little bit.
Oh, you didn't lose any wheels or anything?
Didn't lose any wheels. It was a fairly small line.
Okay.
So nothing crazy with that one. But that was the – I don't know if you know – have you done anything with Jason Pacheco?
No.
Okay, so
– Oh, Jason Pacheco. He's out of Cali, right?
Yeah. Sniper.
Yes.
Yeah,
he's missing the leg.
Yep.
Yes, I know, Jason. We helped him years ago. He went on a hunt. He's done a few things with us. I haven't talked to him in a while. I need to reach out to him.
Was,
yeah,
he was
Jason.
One of my Marines. I'm the one that actually the first one on the scene when he lost his leg.
Really? Let's hear this story.
Yeah, so.
That's hilarious.
We were in a tick.
Okay.
And.
Explain what a tick is for everybody listening.
So, troops in contact, we were pinned down, essentially. Gosh, we were in this firefight for like a good 4 hours.
That's what I remember. It was a long one, right?
It was a really long one. And I always remember the smell is so distinct to me because it was in a giant marijuana field. But when later on when we found out where the enemy was and could lock onto him, we called in for an airstrike. And the airstrike happened. And we were probably at the time not even a K away from our main base.
Yeah.
So we had the big camera, the gyro camera up, and they still wanted us to go do a BDA, even though the camera could see exactly what the strike was and, like nobody lived.
Yeah.
You could see body parts and stuff flying. But they still
What'd
wanted
they
us to
with?
Go do a bad 500 pounder. Okay. And we were like 300 yards away from that shit. We were danger close. That rocked our world. It was crazy.
I mean, a 500 pounder is a JDAM, right?
Yeah.
So they dropped a JDAM 300 yards from you.
Yeah. It was fucking wild. It was wild. So we had to go through this giant marijuana field, and by this time it was dark, like pitch black.
Yeah.
So I grabbed the minesweeper, and it was like me, and I had... two of my other snipers with me, and then a couple other guys back. It was like a 8-man patrol, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I start sweeping this thing, and Jason's right behind me, like about 50 yards behind me, but on the same line. Step right over this ditch, and then keep walking, and all of a sudden it's like, boom. And I was like, fuck, are we getting mortared, or what the hell is going on? And I look back, and obviously Jason is down, so I ran... swept all around him and started like bandaging him up. And he was in shock at this time. He's pretty messed up. And I was like, he's like, am I okay? I'm like, yeah, you're good. I didn't want to say anything because I was like, finding the more I looked, the more I found,
Ugh.
And I was like, dude. So finally got it to where I like slowed the bleeding down a little bit, called the corpsman over. We got him hooked up and then got him medevaced.
How bad was it?
It was pretty bad. So he had lost, you know, like half of his leg. His junk was all torn up. He did like parts of his rifle and stuff all over in his body.
No kidding.
Yeah. He was pretty messed up.
That's what people don't understand is when you get hit, it's how much shrapnel from your own personal stuff or other people or animal parts or whatever it is that guys find embedded in them like years later. Like
I had Marines with on the deployment after that one get like bone fragments from a guy's in front of them in their face and stuff when they got blown up. It is crazy. But
so Jason gets hit. I'm about to have him on the podcast since we're talking about him.
He would be a good one to have on. He's hilarious. Oh, for sure. He always tells everyone, he's like, this is my brother. He's had his fingers inside of me. he loves telling people that. I'm like, dude, you're so messed up.
He's a character for sure.
He's a character. But as we were putting him on the bird, he was singing the Zac Brown Band song, A Little Bit of Chicken Fried.
Okay.
And so when I came back after that deployment and he is out of Bethesda and stuff, we went to a Zac Brown Band concert together. That was pretty awesome.
That's cool.
But yeah, he's funny. That was crazy. So that was probably like that was probably the craziest thing we had on that deployment. We had a few other guys pretty seriously injured, but no one died on that one. So we came back from that one, which ended up being a lot longer than it was supposed to. My wife at the time was like, I just told her that it was just a deployment. She didn't know it was a volunteer thing, so she was like, what the fuck?
Well, she found out that it was volunteer?
Yeah, later on she did.
Oh, I bet you that went over real well.
Yeah, it was good.
Yep.
But then, gosh, I think we didn't have maybe like 6 months back in States, and then we went
right back again. Damn, so this is your fourth deployment? Fifth deployment.
This would be my fifth.
Jesus, dude.
So we went to, on this one, Musa Kala, Afghanistan. And our patrol base was just north of Sangin, where our company was at.
Mm-hmm.
Flying into there was probably like the craziest flying experience.
Oh, so?
For me, just because it was, they're like, this area you guys are going into is like super hot. Like, expect to get off the helo, like being shot
under fire. Yeah.
So that was like intense. No, it was pretty quiet going in, actually. But it was like the energy levels was different from any other deployment kind of going.
Why, like personal, or you can just feel it in the air? That it was
just feel it in
pure
the air.
Evil in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we each kind of platoon through like this whole AO. We kind of set up our own little things and did our own little things for a while. But that's when they were starting to do the teardown about like halfway through that deployment. Okay. So we ended up kind of bringing all the platoons into one base.
And what year is this?
2011, 12.
Okay.
So we brought everybody into one base and then we started doing things like just north of Sangin where it was still really bad.
Yeah.
And we were doing, we did a giant clearing operation through there. Our CO at the time was huge on, we're going to do everything at night. So everything, all of our workup, everything was done with MVGs at night. So that was like the first like kind of big media thing that we're excited about. Like this whole company is operating everything at night. So it was pretty cool being able to do that. But we did this big push from north of Sangin down into Sangin. And that was crazy. There was tons of IEDs everywhere.
When you say tons of IEDs everywhere, like explain to me what.
Like every ditch crossing, there was an IED. It seemed like
you're just getting hit, or you're finding them, or
finding
what?
Them.
Are you getting out and sweeping these things?
So this push was all on foot for about 2 or 3 miles.
Okay.
Through these big. Like this little valley just north of Sangin.
Okay.
So we pushed through that and like halfway through set up because we were doing like door-to-door stuff. So about halfway through we'd set up a little base on this like, I don't know. It looked like a giant dirt mound.
Okay.
But we found 20 IEDs on this one dirt mound. They were just everywhere.
And you're sweeping these with metal detectors. We're sweeping and them. You're just digging
actually,
them up.
Actually, on that one, too, the one of our EOD guys got hurt, and we had to medevac him out. He lost both his legs, I think, on that one.
Was Marine guy?
That was, I don't think it was, I think it was Army EOD. Okay. With
I just met a Marine EOD guy. He's local, and he's missing both legs, so.
Yeah. So that was crazy.
So when you're finding these things and you're digging them up, are you popping them there or are you just defusing? Like, you have an engineer with you that's just...
A lot of times the EOD guys would just...
throw C4 on it
throw
or...
Throw C4 on them and get rid of them right there.
Really? Mm-hmm. And then you just move on to the next one. Yep. And then the next one.
Yep.
That's how it was, huh?
That's how it was. And it was... They were everywhere, man.
Fuck that.
Even after we did that big clearing operation...
Still
you would still
them.
Go there and you still find them everywhere.
How are guys just not getting completely annihilated every day?
I don't know.
Pure luck?
Lucky. Really? I had a few guys. One guy that lives here, near here, lost his legs. He's a triple amputee, but that was probably our worst injury on
What's
that
his name?
Deployment. Mosier, Kyle Mosier.
I don't know.
So he's a really cool guy. But that was probably our worst injury of the whole deployment. We got super lucky on that deployment.
Really? And you got hit on that
one?
I
got hit on that one as well.
Wait, so how many deployments?
That was during that same push, actually.
So you've done 5 deployments, and you've been hit on how many?
Well,
3 out of the 5?
Hit 5 times, yeah, 3 out of the 5 deployments.
Good Lord, bro.
I know. Right?
That same mission,
we set up halfway through that push on a different hill. Actually, this was the next day, so this was like a 3-day operation. The second day, we set up on a different hill, and the COP had been set up there all day long, mm-hmm. right? So we did our push. Our platoon was the last one to come in, and it was dark at this time, and there was like this weird kind of half winding hill that went up, but it like drop off on both sides to get to where the company CP was set up at, and it was dark and we had mine rollers and shit on the MRAPs, and I was like, I'm just gonna jump out and ground guide you up there so you don't drive off the side. I jumped out and like walked in front of this mine roller, and I was probably like 10 feet in front of this thing, and we drove for maybe like 50 yards. And all of a sudden, it was like, poof. So the mine roller hit a 40-pound HME.
And you're standing in front of this thing?
About 10 feet in front of it.
And wait, what? How big was this?
40-pound HME.
Explain this.
So, I don't know how to put it. It's huge. It's a big explosion. It blew the mine roller completely apart.
And for everybody listening, a mine roller, at least ones we had with all the wheels.
Yep.
So imagine like a... Like almost like a combine or like a plow.
Yeah, kind of like a combine is about, yeah.
Or a plow you would tow behind in a field to roll a field, but in front of the vehicle. And it's got wheels and
like weighted plates.
Yeah, big heavy plates to be able to trigger any pressure plates or just any IEDs in general. So this is a big, heavy piece of machinery. And it destroyed this?
It destroyed it.
And you're standing
right
up?
It ripped my flak and weapon off of me. Knocked me out completely, like face dead down in the dirt. Everybody thought I was disintegrated because you couldn't see me because all the dust and everything.
You were gone.
Yeah, they thought I was dead for sure.
Damn,
dude. And one of my Marines, I was just hanging out with him not too long ago. He's like, I remember running up and being like, oh, my God, he's dead. And then you just sit up like you just woke up from the dead. You just sit up and you're like, okay, I'm good. I got so, like, I had a little bit of shrapnel in my back, and that was it.
What?
Knocked me out. That was it, though. I got so lucky that
Bro.
One of those weighted plates, I don't know what they weigh, probably 250, 500 pounds, but they're like the size of a refrigerator.
I've never seen one moved, yeah.
It was laying, like, inches from me, like, right beside me. So if it would have just been a couple inches, it would have flattened me. It was crazy. I was like... So I didn't tell my wife.
And you haven't bought any lottery tickets.
No. So at this time, right, I'm like, I think we had New York Times with us.
Okay.
And they were reporting and doing stories and different things on this push that we were doing.
Oh, no.
And I didn't tell my wife that I got hurt or anything. because they didn't send me out. They just pulled the shrapnel out. It was just small little bits and gave me like a couple days down. And then like...
Told you to change your socks.
A month or so. Yeah, basically. A month or so later, that article came out. And my wife goes, what's this? She's like...
You got published in the New York Times.
Name and everything.
For getting blown up and your wife has no idea.
The reporter was right there. It's, yeah.
How did you...
I was like,
you're still married?
Oh, so this happened. And she's like,
by the way, don't freak out.
And on this appointment, well, yeah, these two, I just had our son was just born too. So he was probably like 1 year old during this time. But she was like, what the hell are you doing? But.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so that was crazy time.
So she has put up with all of this shit.
Yeah.
Good for her, man. Good for you guys.
She is awesome. Yeah, she's a saint, for sure.
I was talking about it on one of the last previous shows that I've seen a lot of horrible things with wives. I'm sure you have too, being in even 20 years. But as far as like guys that get wounded and just, it's hard to find a good one, man.
It is, for sure.
I mean,
just the shit they put up with day to day.
Being our punching bags.
Basically. Yeah, it's crazy.
Good on them, man. I hope there's organizations out there that are just for spouses that are dealing with our shit.
They need
PTSD
it.
PTSD, too, dealing with all of our shit. Yep. I guarantee you, bro. Yep. I know there's little groups and stuff, but there needs to be more for good military wives, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there's a lot of military wives out there, but I want to say the percentage of solid ones that have always had their husbands back and their best interests, it's not a lot.
No.
I don't run into it very often. So good for her.
Yeah.
But damn, so she gets the
news. She gets the news through an article. Yeah, I was like,
oh, my God.
Well, you know, I didn't want to worry you. She's like, whatever.
Oh, my God, man. That is wild.
Yeah.
So you finished that up.
Finished that one up.
And that's it.
That was it.
Deployment-wise.
So I got orders to Bridgeport.
So that's where I'm fascinated to talk to you, because I've driven by Bridgeport a million times, and I'm from upstate New York where 10th Mountain is, so that's where they do all their cold weather training. So I grew up in, like, where the Army goes to do their miserable, don't want to be training, and that was just life for us.
Oh, right.
So, I mean, I love it, but, like, mountain warfare training technically, right? Or are you teaching survival skills?
A little bit of everything. So,
okay. So break down what Bridgeport is and where it's at.
So Bridgeport's kind of like Central California, just south of Reno. It's in the Sierras. Super
beautiful.
Super beautiful area. You know, we train the bases at about 7,000 feet. So we train anywhere from 7,000 to 11,000 feet's the highest point at the base there. So do all kinds of stuff. Me growing up in Colorado was a perfect
fit.
When the monitor's like, well, we've got space in Bridgeport. You want to go there? I was like, yep. So went there, become an instructor. A red hat is what they're known as.
Okay.
It's kind of like their thing. You teach people how to ski, how to climb, how to move through the mountains.
For what? What is the point of this? Is it just one of those old school schools that we were going to fight Russians someday and have to know this cold warfare mountain training?
Yep,
is that the reason of it?
Yeah, it's you know, just to be prepared for anything, any climb, any place, you know, that's what the Marines say. So, I mean, we still send battalions to Norway every year to do training over there. So it's just, you know, how to move and operate in different environments. And
how to stay alive in the snow.
And really what Bridgeport, what Bridgeport really does is like take your group of guys and it weeds out the weak ones from the strong ones.
Okay.
That's the best place to find it. And it's really good for building cohesion and making teams work together, because it's hard to move through the mountains, especially with all your gear and weapon systems and things. It's tough.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's, I mean, obviously in Afghan, there's a lot of elevation and mountains. So I just I don't know anybody that's ever like operated in like this. When I think of Bridgeport and Coleridge, I just think of like feet of snow.
Yeah.
Snowshoes trying to like, start a fire. That's the only thing I think of. I guess I don't think of like the off season where it's, you know, obviously it's still mountain training. So I get, I get it now. So yeah, I never got to go and do anything like that.
It's miserable.
Even as an instructor, it's miserable.
Being an instructor, you have your perks.
I always
said it's like the hot hidden secret gem of the Marine Corps to be able to work there as an instructor.
Really?
Especially if you like the mountains. Cause I mean, I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved every minute of being up there. They have different things. So they have training set up for units that come there that can do, mm-hmm. you know, all of their big unit type stuff in the mountains. And then you have your specialized schools where you have, you know, your mountain medicine, and they focus a lot on, you know, getting patients out of rough areas, but they do a lot of other like high tech stuff. So we do a hype lab there as well, where you get in this ice water for 15 minutes. So you get up to 15 minutes, you get to feel your body fully like start to go into a hypothermic state. And then you come out and you get to learn how like the body temperature raises and lowers as you're going back to a normal state, and get to feel those ups and downs, you know, and how to rewarm, and you got to change your own clothes and do all your own things.
How many guys just completely, I feel like, I don't care how tough you are.
It sucks. It sucks, yeah. No matter what. 50,
I mean, I'm one of those weird ice bath people. Like, I love it. No, I don't. Let me rephrase that. I don't love anything about it. I think it's the dumbest shit ever. But it feels so good. You know, when I do it, especially just... I
always feel like super energized after it. Oh,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
But, like, I hit that 3-minute mark, and I'm like, if I get, I'm out. Yeah. Like this is good for me. Like, I have nothing to prove to anybody anymore. Like,
minutes. A lot of people just, like, shut down. Like, you get a couple minutes, they just, like, stop talking. Like, they'll get in there at first and be like, oh, yeah, it's not bad. And then they'll just shut down. Like, the last 5 minutes is total silence, just waiting to get out.
Just trying to focus. Yeah, I'm trying not to die.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Is there guys that ever just, like, absolutely not? They get in, they're just like, no, or is it?
Nah.
Because I feel like whoever's doing that is probably more recon, MARSOC dudes, or is it, are they putting just normal grunts through that?
Anybody that goes through the winter mountain leaders course, and anybody that goes through like the winter medical course that's up there, they'll go through that. So
that's got to be
rough. And then sometimes you'll do like, depends on the snow and the conditions, you'll do like an ice breaking drill where you're like on skis.
Okay.
And we cut a big hole in the lake that's up there, and you fall into the ice, and you got to get yourself out with your skis, pack everything, and you got to get yourself out. Strip down, rewarm, do all your drills, and get everything.
So when these guys are going through this and they're getting wet, are they, like, going back to hooches at the end of the day, or they're living on the mountain?
Sometimes they'll go, like, back to a hooch. So, like, the ice-breaking drill, we usually try and coordinate that with, the end of the exercise.
Okay, so they're not
just... fall in, and you'll do all your rewarming drills, get completely warm and reset, and then you'll go back at the end of the day.
Oh, so they're not living up there after. Okay. Yeah.
So when I worked with the Royal Marines for 3 years,
mm-hmm. where we up would do there it or
in Norway?
You went to Norway and worked with the Royal Marines over there?
Yeah, I did 4 years.
We could finish Bridgeport if you want. That's fascinating. I can't wait to hear about this.
Yeah. So that's Bridgeport in a nutshell. But yeah. I was a MLC instructor. What's and then that? Mountain leader course instructor. Okay. And then I did the scout skier assault climber course. I was like the chief of that for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I went and did like the chief instructor, where you're kind of in charge of all the courses and making sure everything's being taken care of. So I did that as a gunny. And after that, I thought I was going to go back to the fleet. But they needed somebody to go to the UK, because we have a mountain leader position there. Yeah. The guy that was there before me just did a horrible job and fucked it all up. Like, they were going to shut the program down.
That bad, huh?
And, yeah. And, so they're like, dude, you need to go do this. So I got to go there, take the family there for 3 years.
I was just going to ask if you got to bring the family
there. It was awesome.
So you got to move your family to Norway.
Well, we went to the UK.
Okay.
So, stationed in the UK, but I was gone away from the family about 9 months out of the year.
Oh, okay.
Because the Royal Marines don't have all the training they need within the UK. So we'd go to Switzerland for 3 months, Norway for 3 months. I'd spend tons of time in Scotland and Cornwall. What? We'd do all of our stuff.
Good for you, Finland, man. I guess you got the... nobody ever comes out on the Marine Corps, up on the Marine Corps.
The last 10 years of my Marine Corps career were... amazing.
Dude, good for you, man.
Yeah.
You got to go to Switzerland, all on the Marine Corps dime. It's the least they can do, getting you blown up five times.
So I did a lot. This is true. I got to do a lot in Switzerland, Norway, Finland.
What type of training are they doing? So was it a lot that just transitioned from Bridgeport our style, or was it like completely different tactics? Were you teaching them our tactics or their style?
I would help incorporate it some.
Okay.
Because our stuff at the Mountain Warfare Training Center here is a little more technical than what they do.
How so?
We're more into like rope systems and mechanical advantage and different things like that, whereas they're more into their whole Mountain Leaders is built around their recce stuff. So recon, their snipers, that's all what their Mountain Leaders are built on. So they would do the technical stuff but not get as much to it as they would do like the operating stuff of, you know, observation and different things, movement, things like that is what they're big on.
Which one would you prefer, or is there one that makes more sense over the other, or is it all just kind of a combined equal? Because I mean, why are they focusing on so much more on that and we're focusing on the technical side of things? Like, is there an advantage to one over the other? Or is it just their style of fighting?
I think it's just their style, but I like the way they do things better, if that makes sense, because their course to be their different levels or whatever, their minimum course, you know, you're going through like a 9-month-long course for their basic Mountain Leader.
9 months?
Yeah.
But these aren't your everyday grunts over there. These are all Special Forces dudes, right?
Yeah, these are all, so... I mean, yeah, going over there for me was, I thought I was in good shape going over there. It was like a shock. Those dudes were in like phenomenal shape.
Really?
Yeah, like ridiculous.
You weren't, coming from Bridgeport straight over there? And you,
yeah, they I were... thought I was like, oh, I was like, I'm running like 19-minute 3 miles. I was like, oh, I'm good shape, you know? And then get over there, and those guys just blow. One of their requirements just to join their Mountain Leader course is 10 miles in 70 minutes.
So 3 miles, I was a fast runner in the ring. Not anymore. Good God, and that was 100 pounds ago. But I'm trying to figure out what that pace would be.
Well, 7-minute miles.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's sprinting.
You're flying.
You're sprinting.
For 10 miles.
That's their basic requirement?
That's just to get into the basic course. One of their things. You also do a 21-mile hike with your full gear navigation. It's not like here's your point, you go here. You're navigating and all your gear through the marshes and shit of the UK. It's horrible. It is horrible.
Were you doing this with them, or is that just
sometimes I'd do it with them, sometimes I wouldn't.
Yeah, I would shoot. I'd probably.
But most of my stuff over there was, so they have different ML1s, ML2s, and ML3s. Their ML1s are their senior.
Like different tiers?
They're top tier guys. Okay. So I would focus on... When I was there, it would be the ML1s teaching the ML2s in the courses, and ML2s would kind of teach the threes. So I was in charge of helping with the ML1s and showing them how to do the training and helping them through the technical stuff and doing things like that.
Dang, man.
Which was awesome. I loved that. Was like the best highlight of my Marine Corps career by far.
I bet. Especially after going all through all the crap that you went through. You know, and then you're like, finally, this is awesome. It's paying off for sure.
Yeah.
So after you finished up over there, you got to be close to 20 at this point, right?
17. So I finished there, and then Bridgeport wanted me back. So I went back to Bridgeport as the operations chief.
Damn, you skated, bro.
Yeah,
good for you.
I got lucky. So when I retired, I was the most senior Mountain Leader in the Marine Corps. Like, people would ask me, you know, for things.
Oh,
it was crazy.
Yeah, especially after going overseas, and you probably learned so much. Okay, so here's a question for you. Did you bring back any of their tactics and try to integrate? Because I was wondering as you were talking, like, how many guys, like, that are in your position go from learning our tactics and then going overseas and learning more technical or better tactics and then get out from that point and don't get to bring anything back, but you got to bring it back.
Yeah, that was the big thing. Going over there was like, okay, when you come, like, when you're done, you should come back here and bring that knowledge base back
And
here.
Were you able to do that?
Yeah.
So you got to implement a bunch of new training styles or what?
Ish. So with, like, the way it works, like, you know, how the Marine Corps is, like, we got our way of doing it. We're going to keep doing it that way. You can change certain things. I mean, Bridgeport writes the manuals on it, so we can kind of tweak things, change things. We also... It's like a flip-flop. So a color sergeant from the Royal Marines also comes to Bridgeport and works at Bridgeport. So you do one for one, basically.
Got it.
So he's there also, you know, helping with all of our mountain leaders courses, training mm-hmm. them, teaching them things, and kind of showing them his ways and doing the things. Yeah, but what we lack on mostly is, like, you know, the patrolling, the movement through the mountains and things, and that's where the Royal Marines really, like, come in handy, and they know it really well.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that is really cool. Good for you, man.
Yeah.
Dude, we're right on time, so this was great. This is a lot. I mean, good for you for getting hit five times and making it.
I guess.
You know? I mean, God dang, man, you need to buy a lottery ticket or something.
Yeah, I know, right?
What
I
a wish. Career, dude. Congratulations on being able to go through everything that you did, dodge five different IEDs, literally.
Yeah.
Who even knows how many more didn't go off? I mean, right? With your track record.
Yeah, probably a lot.
And then to be able to finish off with quite the hell of an experience to finish your career, and your wife, man, I got to give kudos to her. I just, I appreciate a good wife.
Awesome.
So yeah, man. So if there's anything, I haven't asked the other guys this, but if there's anything for any vet that's out there listening that has gone through a bunch of shit, and obviously you've hit almost every spectrum on the list of, you know, from in your time in, and that's those 20 years, is there anything that you would like to share? Any word of advice that anybody listening, you know, how did they handle some mental stress? I mean, is there,
you know, I think I'm a really introverted person
mm-hmm.
and, you know, having gone through some of the things I've gone through, I think at times have made it worse. So being able to have opportunities and do things like this, you know, Wishes for Warriors and different things is huge to me, because it gets me out and it gets me to meet new guys that, you know, have done the same thing, seen the same things, and talk with them and laugh about it and kind of have a good time.
Because you do some stuff with some other organizations too, right?
I do as well.
You can go ahead and
shout. Wounded Warrior Outdoors is a huge one.
Cool.
I've done a lot with them, and
they do too. Some incredible things.
Yeah, and that's how I met Dom and some of these guys.
So you would recommend, guys, I mean, if anybody listening, I mean, if there's a lot of programs out there, and so you're saying there's a lot of good things.
Yeah, Hunting for Heroes is a good one that I did some stuff with them. Operation Cherry Bend kind of works with them as well.
Yeah.
But.
And it helped out.
Huge.
Okay.
It's like got me out. Even my wife has been like, you know, you started doing these things, you're a totally different person.
It good.
Kind of opens me up a little bit. I'm a quiet dude. And
yeah. Well, we're going to get you out of your shell if that's still a thing this weekend. So, you know, we've got a really cool trip ahead of us. That's where I was fortunate enough to sit down with you real quick, because you just got into town.
Yep.
And you guys are headed up to Tamarack here for a snowboarding clinic with our organization. So we got a really good group of guys. We got some OG guys that are in here, and then we got half the other group is a bunch of new guys. So
dude, I'm looking forward to it.
It's going to be an interesting time, especially, I mean, you know, Dom, and that's always,
that's just a good time in general.
It's just Dom. Right. And so you can't not have a good time with Dom around, and Eric and all those guys are all solid dudes. But, yeah, man, I hope you get something out of this week. And I want to thank you very much for coming on the show and, you know, sharing some of your story. And I know this is your first one, and I don't know if you're a little nervous or not, but you did an incredible job. So
awesome. Thank you.
Go up there this weekend, have a good time, meet some dudes, and then however we can help you in the future. I mean, I'll definitely have to have Pacheco on.
So. I appreciate it.
Thanks, dude. I appreciate you coming on, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.